This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. Five-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
All right, now that we got that out of the way, we're going to have a serious conversation. Thank you, Dave. Have a great weekend. With apologies to Teddy Coretta, astronomer at Lowell Observatory, specializing in comets and asteroids. Professor, I thought, you know, we'd get it out the way, right, rather than have the snickering in the classroom. What do you think?
No, it sets the tone very effectively. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's talk about being an asteroid detective. Is that what you are?
I suppose it's a little bit of a romantic way to put it. I use telescopes on the ground and in space to figure out where asteroids are, where they're going, and measure what they're made out of.
I guess we should start by talking about what an asteroid actually is. I think some people think it is, but maybe don't.
Sure, sure. So, you know, if you ask a little kid what an asteroid is, they're probably going to say, oh, it's a space rock. And that's most of the way to being the whole story, right? Mm-hmm. It's the rocky stuff in the inner solar system, but, you know, these are objects that are smaller than the moon, smaller than Mars. They can still be hundreds of miles across, but most of the ones that get close to the Earth are just a couple of miles or smaller. You know, they're pretty varied, right? You know, I think people have this idea, oh, they're just rocks. Or maybe if they've gone meteorite hunting, they think they're all metal, right? But they can range from ones that are about as dense as water, really kind of fluffy dirt clods, all the way up to things that are just as dense as iron themselves. They're a really varied and interesting group of objects, and just a handful of them are a little bit dangerous.
Well, we tend to think of an asteroid, at least I do, as like this big, massive chunk of hardened lava, this piece of a mountain that broke off. But that's not necessarily the case?
Yeah, some asteroids, you're totally right, look and are just like hardened lava. They were formed by volcanic processes billions of years ago in the early solar system, but some are completely different. There are asteroids that are really, really bright, made out of material just like the moon is. There are asteroids that are actually darker than coal. You know, there are people who've spent their entire lives trying to figure out what these things are made out of, and they keep finding new kinds of asteroids. They keep finding new things they didn't think of before. There's a lot to learn.
So how do we know, like, in terms of density, is it like a rock? Is it like a sponge? Is it like a rotten piece of wood where it looks heavy, but it's really not?
No, that's the rotten piece of wood analogy is actually really fun and interesting. So we have a couple of different ways that we can learn what asteroids are like, what they're made out of, and maybe what their densities are. If we go up and visit them with a spacecraft, you can just feel the gravity of the asteroid pulling on the spacecraft. You can measure how massive it is and get a really good measurement of how big it is, how dense it is, you know, how much danger it might pose to us. But we know of over 1.5 million asteroids. We've seen about 10 with spacecraft. We have to do a lot of inference to get the others. So that means we're using telescopes on the ground to, for instance, look at how they reflect light. You know, just like how if you, you know, are out on a hike, you can probably tell the difference between dirt and rock just by looking at it, the color of the rock. We can do the same thing with telescopes to try to tease out their composition. Different compositions of asteroids reflect light differently. And because we can compare them to, for instance, rocks on the ground, maybe meteorites that have also fallen from space, we can compare how the two objects reflect light. And if they match, well, maybe they have the same properties. So we can kind of assume that, you know, maybe this rock that we found on the ground that has a density of, let's say, twice that of water, maybe that's a good analogy, a good model for this asteroid out in space that reflects the same kind of light.
I know about that rotten wood thing. True story, had a raccoon cornered, and I just wanted a raccoon to get over the fence and leave, so I decided to just pick up a piece of firewood and throw it at him and turn out to be one of them rotten pieces, and he just looked at me like I was crazy. So I ran in the house, and the story ended happily. When it comes to these lighter, less dense asteroids, I don't know what happens with gravitational pull, the atmosphere, et cetera. Are those harmless, or do we know how many hit the Earth each day?
That's a fabulous question. So you're totally right that as you go to these weaker and weaker and weaker asteroids, you know, when they decide to, you know, get close to us, so when they get close to us, they're not making a choice, you know. Mm. When they hit the atmosphere, the weaker ones can break up really harmlessly. Not all of them, but it means that when we're worried about protecting the Earth, protecting everyday people from asteroids and the dangers they pose, these smaller ones we're just not as worried about. And the weaker ones we're just not as worried about. We do know that those are probably more common, so that means that there's a lot more of that stuff that hits the Earth. It just so happens that, you know, we're all happy and we don't have to worry about asteroids that much. It's just not a big issue, even if these things hit us all the time.
So let me take a step back here when we talk about the way they, you said they don't decide to. What is it that determines whether or not an asteroid hits the Earth or not?
Right. So broadly, we classify asteroids by the kinds of trajectories they're on, which part of the solar system they're in. Most asteroids, the vast, vast, vast majority, are what we call in the main asteroid belt. It's outside of Mars, really far away. But every once in a while, asteroids escape from the main asteroid belt and get a little bit closer to us. This is caused by just repeated slow pushes by Jupiter, by Mars, by Saturn, by the Earth, right? It's a slow, slow nudge, and it takes a long time to build up. So the asteroids that get close to the Earth are, aptly named, the near-Earth asteroids, and we know of about 30,000 of them. These objects, too, even if they're on an orbit that we know of really far today, you know, as they get close to the Earth, their orbits get nudged and change over time. So that's part of why NASA and all the other space agencies don't just try to find asteroids, but continue to monitor them and track them afterwards, because their orbits can slowly drift. And as they drift, even if they wouldn't have hit us in the past, maybe they'll be a danger to us in a couple hundred years, a couple thousand years. We want to keep track of that sort of thing, because unless you're looking, you don't know what kind of risk you're in.
Do we know what causes them to change a trajectory? Is it all about gravitational pull, or is there something in space that causes that, or things we launch?
Sure, sure. So there's sort of two factors. The big one, and I think the easier one to explain, is just the slow gravitational nudges from the Earth and the other planets, right? There's also the fact that as these asteroids warm up in the sunlight, they have to then, you know, re-radiate their heat. You know, just like if you pull a hot poker out of a fire, you're going to see it's glowing. Asteroids do that too. And considering some asteroids are really dark, they absorb a lot of sunlight and get quite hot. As they re-radiate the heat, as they, you know, let off that same sort of reddish light, that can slowly push their orbits as well. I know that sounds kind of complicated, and I think, you know, we didn't know this was a really big, let's say, thing to worry about until maybe the 1970s or 80s. But because we know about all the different ways that that process works, we call it the Yarkovsky effect, we can model it really effectively. We can understand it and predict it years, decades, centuries in advance. So all the different things that cause asteroids' orbits to change, we have a good way of modeling. We have a good amount of understanding of how they work.
So somebody texted in, and I want to open the Okunar Jeweler talking text line here, because, look, there are no dumb questions when it comes to this, and I think I've already proved that. 504-260-1870. We're talking about asteroids and what kind of threat they could be to the Earth, and we're talking with a so-called asteroid detective, an astronomer at Lowell Observatory, which is in Flagstaff, right, Professor?
Yeah.
Specializing comments and asteroids. Sounds like the birds are out singing. No worries. We're bird friendly here. We like that. Is there some kind of, like, you know, we all have security systems in our home these days, right? We know if a door is open, or we know if some area is a secure area is has been violated or whatever. Is there one giant thing going around the Earth like that, where we know whatever it is that's either approaching the Earth or coming in, or that has landed?
No, that's a great question. We have a bunch of different systems that all do part of that. Mm-hmm. So the Earth's a big place, right? It means that we need lots of different countries to kind of pitch in to help figure out all the different ways to hunt for potentially dangerous asteroids, to track them in advance, and we're getting better at it all the time. We use, as sort of the first line of defense, there are groups of people at telescopes all around the world who spend all night, every night that it's not cloudy, scanning the night sky for new asteroids. This is what they do every day of every year, including the holidays. It's a really kind of a thankless job, and I think it's something that the public doesn't know too much about. There are people who kind of live almost a monastic lifestyle up on the mountain, just doing what they can to keep the rest of us safe. That's really good at detecting asteroids days, weeks, months in advance before they might do anything to get close to us, put us in any danger, and that's usually enough time that we can sort of make a plan. When it comes to sort of the smaller stuff that might be harder to find, you know, with telescopes, you're seeing these objects far away, so small stuff far away that can be pretty dim. The smaller stuff is not often so dangerous. It'll burn up in the atmosphere, but that's sort of the next frontier, is we want to get even better at finding the smaller things that might not be, say, world-ending, like Armageddon or Deep Impact, right, but are still worth thinking about and tracking and, you know, preparing for.
Don't Look Up, a good movie as well. Jennifer Lawrence spent some time on a mountaintop making sure that we were all safe. How coordinated is that effort? And when you said it relies on countries cooperating, universities, government, tell you what, Professor, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Nothing just happens, right? And the classic example I give is, even if it's a PTA meeting, somebody's got to set up the chairs and bake the cookies and put out the table skirts and all that stuff. So nothing just happens, I would think. It's especially complicated when it comes to scanning the universe to make sure that Earth's not in trouble of any killer asteroids. Got any questions, comments? 504-260-1870. I must tell you, with all the political this and that and the other thing, I'm more worried about asteroids than anything. That's what I think is going to do the Earth in. One of these days, somebody's going to miss something, and all of a sudden, we won't even hear boom. We'll just hear ka. More when we return. 260-1870, 504-260-1870.
Hey. I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Omisid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Omisid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at omised.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
7 if you have any questions or comments. Friday morning, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:26, we're talking about asteroids. If you're looking for Ian McNulty, he was on yesterday, had a conflict, couldn't come on today as we normally do on Friday. So you can find out all about eating and drinking if you go to WWL.com, find my name and click on the audio or download the Odyssey app. Either way, meanwhile, we're talking about asteroids and being an asteroid detective, so to speak, with Teddy Coretta, an astronomer at Loyal Observatory specializing in comets and asteroids. So, Professor, when it comes to this integration, if you will, this coordination of effort, who drives this? Things don't just happen, right? So if you're talking about scanning the universe to make sure that the Earth is either safe from asteroids or maybe having a an alternate plan, and we'll get to that in a minute about alternate plans, how coordinated is the effort? Is anybody in charge of this, or is it just a lot of people volunteering? Take me through that.
You're right. It's a complicated thing, and it takes a lot of people working together. It started kind of informally with the different international space agencies, like the European Space Agency, NASA, of course, JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, sort of developing their own plans in sometime in the early 90s, sort of right before asteroids got big in the news, right, when they started making all the big blockbusters. People started realizing that asteroids are a global threat. Right. When you discover an asteroid, you don't know if it's going to hit your country or someone else. You have to work together. In some sense, it's never actually been a huge issue to get the countries to work together. The question is, how fast can we do it? How well can we do the job?
So with that being said, are you fairly confident that there is enough coordination, enough funding, enough this, enough that to make sure that we continue to keep our eyes on the skies?
I think, you know, there's always a question of, do we have enough people and are we working fast enough? We're getting better at all of these things. And in particular, just as we sort of flex our muscles and actually go through these exercises, you know, I'm sure we're going to be talking about that asteroid that was in the news a couple of weeks ago, 2024 YR4 in a bit. But in particular, by doing these exercises, by following it through, we're getting better and we're getting better at working together. One of the challenges is, you know, it's not quite funding per se, but it's close to, do we have enough people and have we trained enough, you know, new students to take over when the current generation of scientists who maybe were the world's best in the early 2000s are starting to get, you know, think about retiring, moving in with their grandkids, right? You know, we've got to kind of plan for the future if we want to keep people just as safe now as they are in 20 years, right? It's both about planning and about actually running these exercises and getting better in the present.
So when it comes to relative certainty about protecting the Earth from any kind of asteroid, let's go back, since you mentioned, and talk about YR4, a city killer. Tell me what happened there.
Right. So this asteroid got discovered right around the holidays. I think it got discovered on the 27th of December. And, you know, like everyone else, the astronomers of the world take the holidays off, as they should. But, you know, one of the challenges there is that when you discover these asteroids, at first, you don't know, are they on a trajectory that's worth worrying about? It takes a couple of days, often a week or two, before you can actually kind of know, is it just going to get close to us or is this worth worrying about? So by maybe the third or fourth day of the new year, people started to notice, okay, this asteroid maybe has a chance of hitting the Earth. And, you know, we're not talking about betting odds, right? Astronomers care about the small stuff. We start caring when it's a tenth of a percent, you know, one part in a thousand, that's our chance of hitting the Earth. That's when we really start to think about it. Part of the reason there is that because asteroids can move quickly, our understanding of them can evolve quite rapidly, it means that, you know, we kind of need to start getting worried earlier than you'd expect. So the sort of international rule we follow is once somebody finds an object that has a 1% chance of hitting the Earth, you have to tell everyone. You actually were required to report it to the United Nations. We send it off to the other space agencies. It immediately becomes completely public information. There's no more, you know, me working on my own or our team working on our own. So for YR4, right around, you know, maybe that third or fourth day of the new year, that's when everyone started to realize, okay, it's time to take this really seriously. Let's go figure out where it is, where it's going, and if we can, what it's made out of. Part of the way that my team was involved in the efforts to kind of constrain whether or not we were in danger from this object was measuring what it was made out of. And we determined, using our big telescope outside of Flagstaff, that it was primarily rocky in composition. This is, like when we were talking about before the break, you know, the weaker asteroids you don't have to worry about, but the rocks, the metallic ones, those are a little bit more dangerous. YR4 was not some weak little friable thing. This was worth really caring about. So as a result, as the weeks went on, you know, we saw it more and more and more in the news as its impact probability grew. You might ask, how did that happen? We kept tracking it, right?
How did it happen?
So we saw its orbit continue to evolve and refine our understanding of it by repeatedly looking at it night after night after night with big telescopes. We were measuring where it was as precisely as we could. That way, we could kind of constrain the exact specific trajectory it was on. So in addition to not just measuring what it's made out of, we wanted to do our best to understand exactly how fast it was going, exactly where it was. And as we refined our understanding of its orbit, you know, in the news, people saw the impact probability kept rising to 1%, to 2%, to just above 3%. Once it got above about 2.5%, that means it was more likely to hit the Earth than any other asteroid of that size that we've detected in the past, right? This was a big deal. We hadn't had, you know, sort of a real big asteroid to worry about sort of since we really started worrying and developing these all-sky surveys back in the 90s to look for these asteroids. But then all of a sudden, the impact probability went to zero. The reason for that is that more or less, think of it like you're like focusing like the sight of a rifle or something, where like, you know, as it's kind of pulling into view, you start to see the Earth, but you still don't know exactly how focused you are. You still don't know the exact trajectory it's going to take. Once you get everything properly set and you actually know exactly where you're aiming, you kind of know immediately, is it going to hit the Earth or not? As you start to refine the orbit, kind of the area of, you know, the sky that it could be passing through shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and all of a sudden the Earth is outside that circle and you're safe. That's what we've seen when we've run these computer models in the past, and that's what happened here in real life. But we've still never gotten to 3% before. It was a big deal. You know, my mom called me. She was worried, right? But, you know, it's because the scientists worked together and tried to rule in or rule out an impact as fast as we could. That meant we knew as early as we could to determine, do we have to deflect it? Do we have to do some sort of measure to work against it in a couple of years down the line?
How reliable is the science when it comes to, should an asteroid threaten the planet? I'm thinking Department of Defense applications here, either way, from whatever country, that you would be able to predict with some degree of certainty where it was headed?
We're actually really, really good at determining where these asteroids are going, in part just because, you know, the first asteroid actually got discovered about 200 years ago. Ever since then, we've just been getting better and better and better at finding asteroids, at tracking them, at understanding the trajectories they follow through the inner solar system. That whole part of it, that's really set. We know the exact process. You can't do much better than just go back to the telescope every night and just keep looking at where it's going and measuring where it's going over and over and over again. That's the bread and butter technique. It just works. The thing that we don't know as well, and this is what many scientists are working on right now, is thinking, let's say that we find an asteroid that will hit us. What are our options, right? Mm-hmm. What actual...
Well, let me take a step back, Professor. Plans? What about like knowing where it would... Could you predict a continent where this thing would hit or not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So... Okay. So for YR4, before we knew that it wasn't going to hit the Earth, we knew all the places along the Earth which it might hit. In particular, it meant that we knew exactly, you know, the exact like latitudes and longitudes that were possible. And as we understood this object's orbit better, that narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. For an object like this, if we knew for a fact it was going to hit the Earth, well in advance of it hitting the Earth, we would know exactly where on the surface it would hit. There's sort of two benefits to that. The first is most of the Earth's surface is the ocean, right? You know, if you want to roll the dice, most of the asteroids are going to end up in the ocean. That's still not, you know, no risk, but it's, you know, better than it hitting New York or Louisiana or whatever, right? The other thing is that if we know where it's going to hit, maybe we can evacuate people ahead of time. Maybe we can make a plan that's specific to that area and keep people safe.
So when it comes to if one country, say a hostile country, wanted the asteroid, if they find out, say, I'm just picking names out of the air here, country X is an enemy of country Y, and they know an asteroid is going to hit country Y, and they're saying, good, that'll wipe out Y, that the Y would know about it because of the shared information?
Yes. So as soon as any asteroid poses a real threat to the Earth, everyone knows everything. That's the policy. You're right that there are a lot of, let's say, overlapping questions between, let's say, like national defense and national security and asteroid science, right? Back in the 1990s, one of the reasons Congress first started getting interested in funding, you know, asteroid surveys to look for potentially dangerous space rocks was specifically this, you know, let's say two countries are on the brink of war and an asteroid is going to explode in the atmosphere above, you know, the border between the two of them. Even if it doesn't hurt anyone, you hear a big explosion in the atmosphere, you're already a little antsy, you might make a bad decision. You know, people get, you know, afraid of things from outer space, and large explosions are, you know, I think something that would cause a lot of people to jump to conclusions. We want to understand where these things are, sort of for everyone's benefit, to try to prevent exactly the situation you're describing.
So somebody texted in, I think it's a good question, maybe a good way to wrap up the conversation. An asteroid's coming, you know, it's a big one, it's going to be catastrophic. Okay, what do you do? Do you run up your credit cards and have a great time? Is there anything? What would happen then?
Well, that's exactly what NASA and so many other space agencies are doing right now. A couple of years ago, your listeners might remember we did something called the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART. This was NASA's big mission to try to push an asteroid onto a different trajectory. We'd never done this, right? We didn't know how well that kind of technique works, and I'd much rather know if it worked or not before we're in a situation where we have to use it, right? So in that particular case, we realized that if we found an asteroid, let's say with 10 years of advance warning, something like DART, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, we could just push it onto a different trajectory that wouldn't hit us. It's cheap, it's fast, it's reliable. But if we discovered something with, let's say, less lead time, 6 months, 2 years, kind of like the scenarios they bring up in the movies, we're working on exactly the right plans for that right now. You know, the classic one that they bring up in the movies is let's hit it with a missile, right? But there are people who are working on that with PhDs, working in big government labs with big supercomputers, figuring out the exact way that we should do it to be the safest, to be the most reliable. You know, scientists are worried about this just like anyone else. And while I think sometimes it can seem like science fiction to say, let's go hit the asteroid with a missile, we might in our lifetimes find a scenario where that might be the right choice. But we want to know everything we can about that beforehand so we can make a safe choice for everyone involved.
And before we let you go, when you see things depicted in the movies are, I can't think of them right now, they have several of them, but would the effects be like that, similar to that? Do the movies pretty well nail it, or do they over-exaggerate it?
The movies are definitely a little over-exaggerated. And often, you know, the movies, they're trying to be flashy, right? They're trying to get, you know, butts and seats, sell tickets. And as a result, the asteroids that they even show hitting the Earth are a lot bigger than the ones that asteroid scientists are typically worried about. Most asteroids aren't the size of Texas, like in the movie Armageddon. They're a few miles across. So that means that most often, the kinds of scenarios we're worried about, it's not, you know, the end of human civilization. It's damage over a wide, wide, wide area. And it would still be tremendously awful, tremendously dangerous in lots of different ways. But the way that they present it in movies, they're trying to make it look as cool as possible. And in a lot of ways, we're still figuring out exactly what an asteroid impact would look like. We know a lot of the big picture details, but we're working out the small stuff all the time. And I'm actually at a conference this week where we're talking about exactly this. What do asteroid impacts do, and how dangerous would they be?
Professor, a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for your work. I mean that. I appreciate it. Teddy Corretta, an astronomer at Lowell Observatory, specializing in comets and asteroids. If you had to say, Professor, how many things are above the list of things you worry about as it relates to asteroids hitting the Earth? How many? 1,000? 2,000?
It's definitely a couple hundred. You know, I live
a couple
in
of hundred. All right. Well, there you go. That's different. Thank you, sir. 940, 20 till 10. JR has been on fire. We'll have a free pick for us as well as some other information when we return. JR with Taking Vegas right now. Time for WWL traffic.
Hey, I'm Josh Fink, owner of Nick's Menswear. Getting married? Don't rent some random suit. At Nick's, we help you own the look for about the same price as a rental. You're marrying the love of your life. Don't you deserve a suit that's yours forever? Nick's Menswear, your friend in style.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Think warm. Think palm trees. Think baseball.
Hi, I'm MLB.com's Matt Monaghan. The long, dark freeze is over, and spring training is finally here. If you're a baseball fan looking for a quick, easy way to get all the scores, top stories, and best sound bites from Florida and Arizona, you're in luck.
I don't think people realize how good we are. I don't even know if we realize how good.
The Morning Lineup Podcast, a short, less than 10-minute baseball highlight show, is available anywhere on any platform you listen to podcasts on, 5 days a week. We can't wait to meet you there.